Good morning. For years, Hawaii has tried to get its medical marijuana dispensary system right. A visiting medical marijuana policy expert hopes to help Hawaii get logistics and the law right as well. We'll talk with James Anthony this morning. And is the seafood on your plate what you think it is, or do you really know its mercury content? A new study says maybe not. Lead author Peter Marco has a few of the reasons. On Thursday, August 21st, from HPR2, it's The Conversation.
Love the bard, but not all the hours it would take to read through his works. How about 97 minutes? The Mission Houses Museum Abridged Shakespeare is back, and we'll get this year's details from director Will Howe. And this may be your last chance for a while to hear McConaughey live in our studio. We'll look to his summer-ending concert. I'm Chris Vandergrift.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. First, this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Somehow that reggae beat seems to transition into our opening subject pretty well.
You think? Well, maybe some folks wouldn't necessarily like that kind of association, but nevertheless, we're going to talk about it for the moment. Now, what we're going to talk about is this: how to make the logistics meet up with the law. That has been the central question about Hawaii's medical marijuana policy. Since 2000, Hawaii has had a medical marijuana law, but crafting the mechanism for distribution, oversight, the responsibility of a primary care physician, and allowable amounts have taken almost 15 years. James Anthony is a Hawaii and California licensed attorney and a former prosecutor for the city of Oakland. He specializes in medical marijuana dispensary land use and is in Hawaii to talk about Hawaii's policy at several statewide meetings. James Anthony joins us now by phone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And should we say to you, welcome home, too?
Yes, I'm home. I'm actually right now sitting in my mother's hometown of Hilo, although I grew up in Manoa and in on Oahu.
So lest anyone think that you're just another mainland guy coming here to tell us a whole bunch of stuff, you know where you speak.
I think I understand not only the various options of medical marijuana policy as found in different states and local governments around the United States, but I'm also sensitive to the very, very special and unique circumstances in Hawaii, not only as a state, but really island by island and county by county.
How would you characterize those unique differences?
Well, I think in Hawaii we have an opportunity to craft a system that is really responsive to the needs of local patients and responsive to the special situation of each county. I don't think the Big Island is going to look like Honolulu when it comes to medical marijuana access, production, and distribution, and nor should it. And the other very, very important part of Hawaii's circumstances is that this is an agricultural state. We're talking about an agricultural product. I mean, somehow this policy discussion sometimes ends up sounding like we're discussing plutonium. You know, it's got to be handled inside under maximum security with 3-foot thick concrete walls. And certainly there needs to be a reasonable amount of security. But, you know, we have very many valuable agricultural products in Hawaii that are grown securely and safely and are not diverted in any way. So I think we need to remember that we need to enjoy and respect our access to fresh water, good soil, and plenty of sunshine. And that's where the best medicine comes from.
So you're talking about not only our agricultural differences here in Hawaii, and certainly island by island, but also different needs of patients island to island. How do you see those needs as being different from someone who is in California?
Well, one thing that comes to mind is we have a particular distribution of patients at the moment under the current circumstances, right? You've got about 13,000 patients, licensed, blue card carrying Hawaii medical marijuana patients. across the state. Half of that 13,000 is on the Big Island, you know, which is a little unusual proportionally. But if you think about it, at the moment, the only reason to have a blue card is if you are going to grow your own medicine, or if you have one person who's going to grow it for you and only for you. That is a very awkward system if you are sick and then suddenly you have to start growing your medicine or get somebody to grow it for you. And maybe if you're lucky in about 8 months, you might have something, right? Generally speaking, if you're sick and you need medicine, you need it now. And the only way to get it now is to go to the underground market, right? The system is completely non-workable in that way. So you find that people get cards where they can actually grow, right? Which tends to be not in city and county of Honolulu, but in the other counties. That will change. Once there are medical marijuana dispensaries where you can buy your medicine with your blue card, then there is a reason to get a blue card. And more people who need them will go get them because it'll be a functional system. We've seen this in state after state. Colorado started out with about 6,000 patients, and then as they created the dispensary system, within 2 years, that had blown up to 10 times more than that, 15 times more than that, 60,000 patients, 80,000, 100,000 patients. So you have to create a reason, an incentive, a system that works, and then people will get the card. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, if you want to, you know, you mentioned California as a comparison. Well, the interesting thing about Hawaii is that on any given day, there are tens of thousands of Californians visiting Hawaii, and we know that there are 1 million medical marijuana patients in California. So you have to figure that, you know, several hundred, if not, you know, thousands or more, of those California patients and patients from other states are in Hawaii on any given day. Do they have their medicine with them? Did they bring it on the airplane? Probably not. And then they get here, and there is zero medical hospitality for them. There is no recognition, no reciprocity. That's wrong. That's shameful. We need to do something about that.
As you talk about an increase in the business side of it, actually people who are going to need to purchase this from a dispensary, there's also the question of, well, what do you do to be able to keep those dispensaries in business? What do you suggest for that?
Well, you know, it depends how they're set up. I mean, in most states, there's kind of a split between the different states. Some of them are being operated for profit. Some of them are being operated not for profit. Functionally, they end up being about the same thing. I mean, you know, the thing with a nonprofit isn't that it can't make a profit. If your revenues are less than your expenses are more than your revenues, you're not a nonprofit. You're bankrupt is what you are. Plenty of nonprofits make big money. I'm a member of Kaiser Permanente. I give them money every month. I never go down there. I know they're making money on me, right? They did $22.5 billion in revenue last year, and I don't think they spent that much money. What makes a nonprofit at law, or at least what they told me in law school, is that there's no owner, there's no shareholder, so the profits don't get distributed. They should really be called non-distributors. Right, so that money cannot go to the owners as a dividend or a draw or return on investment. It has to stay inside. Now, obviously, people get paid salaries, the rent gets paid, the mortgage gets paid. All of the reasonable expenses get paid, but there's just nobody, you know, taking the money off the top. So in both of those cases, they have to be run sensibly like businesses that are going to balance the books. The question is, do you do it on a kind of a small local scale where you try to encourage some diversity and some competition among the available sources? Or are you just going to throw it open to whoever's, you know, the biggest guy with the most money, which is sort of what we're seeing in Nevada right now. Nevada is just received all their applications. In November, they're going to issue their licenses for cultivation, products manufacturing, and retail stores. So probably by February or March, they'll be open for business.
James, we're going to have to go.
Very clearly for-profit system. So that'll be an interesting example.
Now, we're going to have to go in just a second, but I want to get your quick take on this. What about oversight of all of this? I mean, this is going to be moving very quickly from the Department of Safety to public safety, to public health.
Well, you know, they've taken 2 years, actually. The both the legislature and both departments have been very deliberate. So that law passed, not this last session this year, but last year's session, 2013, in April.
But they have until January 1 to make that complete.
January 1 is the official transition date. But both departments have been very cooperative. Public safety has done a really good job of facilitating the transition. Peter Whitaker in the health department, who's overseeing their side, has had 2 years to ramp this up. He's hired somebody to help oversee the thing. I'm very impressed by the job they've done. And now we have this task force that is meeting to work on these issues. And it's very clear that the health department is in the lead and will work with other agencies.
Right, and we've talked with him. I'm just looking for your take on this very, very briefly, because we're going to have to go in just a second. So from your perspective, Hawaii's doing pretty well with this, and this has a good shot of actually coming to fruition fairly soon?
I think so. I think now is the time. The task force will deliver a workable draft to the legislature. It's the legislature's job to finalize that, for the governor to sign it, and then for the health department and the other agencies to implement it this upcoming year, 2015.
All right. I wish we had more time to talk. Perhaps we'll be able to do that in the future. Meanwhile, enjoy being home and all the statewide meetings that you're going to be speaking to folks who have a lot of similar questions. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Yeah, if you look for Medical Cannabis Coalition of Hawaii online, you can find all of our events at mcchi.org.
All right, we'll
put
that
so
on our Facebook page. Absolutely. James Anthony is an attorney licensed in California and Hawaii, and he also holds a California real estate broker license. For 9 years, he's had successful experience in medical marijuana permitting, lobbying, regulation, and litigation in California and other states.
Ulana, umau, ukaholabe, uhangai.
In this morning's backyard quiz, we're highlighting an event that took place 95 years ago today. The event was the dedication of the dry dock at Pearl Harbor. At the time of its dedication, it was the largest, one of the largest and most advanced in the world. The feat was so significant that August 21st was declared a public holiday that year. That's one of the reasons crowds gathered at the dry dock for the ceremony, and it opened with a statement from Rear Admiral W.B. Fletcher, who said, "We are here this morning to dedicate this dock and testify by our presence our appreciation of the foresight, wisdom, and skill of those who are responsible for the inception and construction of this splendid work, and we admire the fruits of their labor." W.B. Fletcher was not the only representative of the Navy who had a role in the dedication, and for today's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the name of the other high-ranking Navy representative present. Here's a hint. At the time, the man we're hoping you can name held the position of Secretary of the Navy. Call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. Otherwise, we'll be back with it in a half hour.
Aloha, I'm Tulsi Gabbard, your Congresswoman representing the 2nd Congressional District. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Everyone loves Shakespeare, but these days, who has the time? If the bard had a fault, it was a tendency toward long-windedness. Easier to get away with when you have an Elizabethan audience, which frankly didn't have that many better things to do than sit through 3 hours of an ancient king's descent into madness or a Danish prince working through his family issues. How much better then for modern audiences to get the gist of the master's work through a performance of the complete works of Shakespeare abridged, a takeoff that boils Hamlet down to 42 seconds and gives it to you forward and backward. Will Howe is directing a new production of this popular play at Mission Houses Museum. He's with us this morning. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
You know, I love the this play addresses what Shakespeare buffs are never willing to say out loud. Like, it does get a little long sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the great thing about this show is that it's a parody. Yeah? So, mm-hmm. just come in for a high energy show that's just nothing sacred. And he wrote for the everyday person, not the elite people. So you're going to have a great time if you come and see it. And we're throwing in a lot of Hawaiian topical, you know, words and phrases as well. So it's a nice mishmash of Shakespeare and Hawaiiana.
And the way the play is it was originally constructed, there's a lot of room for the acting company to alter, contribute, improvise.
Right, right. And we have three wonderful actors, Kevin Kevany, Adam Lefebvre, and Teresa Oliver. And the great thing is that they all know each other, and they're all Poe Keller winners, you know, independent solo performers on stage, the local stage. And you just, as a director, you just let them go and play. And then you can shape them and whatnot. They come up with some wonderful, wonderful scenes. We, you know, like Titus and Andronicus, because we're doing it as a cooking show.
Yeah.
You know, and then we have the tragedies are going to be done as a football game. You know, so it's just high energy. And I know one person who saw one performance and just said, I was exhausted at the end, because it was just nonstop. 97 minutes, 37 plays, that's a lot. You know, and the fact that they all play different characters. You know, the women, Adam plays all the women. Well, I shouldn't tell you too much if you come and see it. But it's
yes, you should tell me too
much. Yeah, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, 7 o'clock. Please come and join us. It's outdoor theater under the stars. It's beautiful.
Tell me about the way the text sort of goes to the themes that you will recognize, but takes off from them. You know, as you say, boiling the tragedies down.
Yeah, well, every play has its own separate entity. And so I just leave it up. Just give a, I just tell the actors what I think this scene needs, and they just go for it. And see, I can't tell you too much because it's going to spoil it. But like I said, the cooking show, Juliet, Teresa Oliver is an actress, obviously, but we have Adam playing Juliet. So there's a whole different, so there's an undertext where the two of them are competing for the female roles, and they finally give her the role of the witch and the shrew. That's it.
Which is also a reference to the fact that the female roles were all
just played. Like Kabuki, it was all done by men.
Yeah.
You know? So we stay true to it in that sense, you know? I think Shakespeare would have a great time if he saw our show. He'd be laughing in the aisles. So far, people have been holding their stomachs. They've been just like laughing so hard they're crying, you know. So
one of the things that people have always loved about this show is that the themes are so recognizable that it isn't as outrageous as you might imagine to take all the history plays and kind of and condense them, you know, shamelessly.
Yeah, I mean, what's happening, what he wrote, you know, hundreds of years ago is like, it's what's happening today, you know, politically.
Whenever you see the machinations of power,
right,
you can always take that back to some sort of Shakespearean theme, because, well, just the whole thing of I'm going to kill everybody who's in my way until I get to the throne.
Right.
I mean, that's half of the history plays and the tragedies there.
Yeah. You know? And I will say this too. We have a lot of audience participation segments in it as well. So the audience gets to be part of it. And the three people I mentioned who are in the cast, what's great about this summer show is that I've assembled just wonderful, not just talented, but just wonderful, good people. And I must say that Lisa Barnes, the assistant director, was there to help out. And my three production assistants, Stephen Royal, Denise Aikuchin, and Alan Lukubo, they're all prominent members of our local theater community. And just wonderful people. It's just so nice to work without any ego. Just go there and just show up and have a good time, you know. It's like family, you know. So I just hope people come up for the last three shows, because the storm really
you got
screwed up
out.
Our schedule, yeah. But anyway.
Or stormed out.
Yeah. So tonight, tomorrow night, Saturday night, please come.
But responses have been good.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, it's opening night standing ovation, you know. It's just great. And they work so hard. They need an audience, you know. But, you know, whoever comes. They'll have a great time.
There's an awful lot of work to be done by these three actors, just in terms of not just a volume of lines to be memorized, but and usually the challenge is staying in character. This is more remembering which character you're going to be
next. In a split second, they're changing hats, costumes, and you know, at the end of the night, they're just soaked. I mean, this is they don't have to go to the gym. They don't have to go to the gym.
So, as director, you're kind of the traffic cop, knows when to back off. Is that part of your
role? It's like being like a good parent, you know, just watching them grow and just giving them hints, clues along the way. And if they stray, just bring them back, you know.
Are you also kind of the one who keeps an ear to the pacing of the show? As you say, 97 minutes.
Yeah.
It's pretty precise.
Yeah, but, you know, the interesting thing is that when you do a show like this, every show is different because there's audience participation. So sometimes, I mean, it's just going to be different no matter what. So you cannot handcuff them, you know.
But they just let them go.
They know when it's too long. And they're smart that way. They're Akamai. You know, they've been around the business long enough to know.
Well, good luck with this weekend.
Thanks for having us on the show, and good luck.
Will Howe is the director of the Complete Works of Shakespeare, abridged at the Mission Houses Museum in Honolulu. It'll be performed tonight through Saturday, and you can find out more at hpr2.org.
Together, we're building HPR into a statewide service that brings together individuals, families, and businesses around the community. Sustaining membership is an important way that you can contribute to the station's growth. We gratefully acknowledge Claude Roth of Honolulu, Douglas Bronick of Makawao, and Karen Victor of Kapolei for being HPR sustaining members. Sustaining membership is a giving plan of $5 or more per month, and it continues until you say otherwise. To become a sustaining member today, you can call us at 955-8821 during business hours or go online and follow the support link on hpr2.org. The CD1 matchup between Mark Takai and Charles DeJoux is starting to simmer. With 2.5 months to the general election, both candidates hope to give you good reason to give one of them your vote, unless party affiliation is your sole criterion. But if issues are driving your vote, there are many differences between the candidates. With a first look at some of them, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us today for a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, FM.
We've had many conversations where they've started with, well, these two candidates are so similar, but that is not the case with Takai and DeJoux. What would you say would be some of the hallmark differences between the two, besides the fact that one is a Democrat and one is a Republican?
DeJoux has been critical of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Takai has wholeheartedly embraced it. The Jones Act concerning maritime shipping in the state, DeJoux thinks it hurts our prices, drives costs up. Takai is a supporter of it. It protects labor union jobs. Gay marriage is another issue. Takai was slow to come around to supporting marriage equality, but eventually did embrace it. And DeJoux was troubled by the special session last fall to get same-sex marriage passed. So those are just three issues that kind of separate the two.
DeJoux briefly held the seat. He'd like to get it back again. The question is, does he have a really good chance? What kind of argument is he going to have to make to be able to garner enough support to overtake Takai?
Perhaps his greatest argument is that the House of Representatives will continue to be dominated by Republicans. That is not going to change. There's even a chance of the Senate, a good chance the Senate could fall. So you'd have two chambers of Congress controlled by the same party. So DeJoux's argument is, hey, it would be good for Hawaii to have a Republican voice in Congress. Maybe they would listen more to him rather than a Democrat like Takai.
But that may fall on deaf ears for a lot of Democrats in Hawaii.
It's rare for us to send Republicans to Washington. Hiram Fong is the only senator who's sent. Pat Saiki, a notable exception for the House. And she was lucky that Saiki is the chair of the Republican Party this year. She did serve two terms. But DeJoux only served briefly. Remember, it was that special election with Ed Case and Colleen Hanabusa. We tend to send Democrats to Congress, so Takai has the edge there.
I know that you're going to be taking a deeper look at both candidates as we move closer to the general election and look into some of the issues like Veterans Affairs and also some key domestic issues as well as foreign policy.
Sure, although it's interesting, I wanted to point out some similarities real quickly. Both of them are in their 40s. Both of them have young families. Both of them served in the legislature. Both are fairly moderate given their party's idealism. And then finally, both of them are active in the military. Both have served abroad. So despite the differences, there are a lot of commonalities between Mark Takai and Charles DeJoux.
All right, that's not exactly the final point they'd like to have us end with, but for the moment, we will. Thanks very much, Chad. We'll talk more about this as we get a little bit closer to all of this. And of course, we have many other issues to talk about as we're moving closer to the general election. And we'll be doing a whole lot more of that right here with Chad Blair and the Civil Beat Reality Check.
Thanks, Beth.
Chad Blair is a political reporter for civilbeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:30. This is The Conversation on Statewide, member-supported HPR2. If you want to be in touch, there are plenty of options. Post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. And you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Tonight at 5, it's Town Square with Beth Ann. And Beth Ann, many lessons to be learned from this last hurricane event.
And maybe some accolades, too.
Yeah.
We're going to take a look and really have a tropical storm debrief. And we hope that you will call in with your take on how the storm happened wherever you happen to be. We'll be talking with Maui Mayor Alan Arakawa and Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, also Vern Miyagi, who we talked to a little earlier this week, the executive officer from the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency, and really get some sense of how things went on the ground and what we can take away from the these great calls that we've been getting to prepare, and did we in fact prepare enough this time around?
Well, there are always things that were not expected, and we can certainly say that we know a lot more about albizia trees than we used to.
Or that perhaps we ever really want to know again, but a lot of people have been making that point about the albizia for a very long time, and it took something like this to focus a great deal of attention. Sometimes that's how it happens. But as we look at the whole experience of the tropical storm and how people prepared, did they prepare enough? Did things go well and as planned? Yes, sure, there's always things that could be differently done and better done, and we're looking to import those hopefully for next time. But in general, how this one went and for a lot of people who got lucky and didn't get hit in the way that the Big Island did or Maui in certain parts did, what happened and how did they prepare and what do we do for next time?
Well, it's the aftermath of an event like this is always as important as the time leading up to it, because you can learn so much. There always will be things for which you could not have prepared.
Well, that's true. And also, as technology changes, and last night on Bite Marks Cafe, they talked a bit about the technology that went into being able to render aid or be able to chart what was happening with the tropical storm. All of that will be changing, too. And so will the way we all prepare, hopefully for the better.
Well, we'll hear about that, and you'll get a chance to weigh in tonight at 5 on Town Square.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Central Pacific Bank, offering private banking, trust administration, and financial management services to help individuals and families reach their financial goals. Learn more at centralpacificbank.com. www.thehawaiiwatch.com.
You've heard that old real estate chestnut, that location is everything. Now it seems that idea may be showing up on your dinner plate. A new study of seafood counters in 10 states shows some fish may be mislabeled, and what you may be bringing home may come from different geographic locations and have a higher mercury content than you may know. UH Professor Peter Marco is the lead author of the just released study, and he joins us now by phone. Thanks so much.
Hi, thanks for having me, Beth.
Well, for a lot of people who are very focused on labeling, I mean, we've seen what's happened with GMOs and the push to have labeling be accurate. This has got to be a real offense to know that perhaps what they think they're buying is not at all what they're getting.
Well, that's true. That for fish, it's well known that many species are substituted for many less desirable species are often substituted for more desirable species. But in our study, we found this interesting and somewhat alarming pattern where fish that should have relatively low mercury can have 2 to 3 times as much mercury, depending on where they're actually caught, not what species they were.
And that's the part that maybe we are a little bit ignorant of as we look at fish counters and we see, okay, so it says Chilean sea bass, but it may not necessarily be sea bass from a specific area that would make it certified. It may be uncertified. We may not know any of that.
Right. And in a previous study from my lab, we showed pretty clearly that when you go to a store and buy a Chilean sea bass, there's a significant number of fish that are not actually Chilean sea bass. And that in itself is not all that unusual. But we also found was that if you go to the store and you buy something called MSC certified Chilean sea bass, which is supposed to be from a fishery in waters around the sub-Antarctic island of South Georgia, because it has been determined by the Marine Stewardship Council, or MSC, to be a sustainable fishery with minimal impact to other species. We showed in this paper that a significant number of those fish weren't actually from South Georgia, but were from other places, probably South America.
So does that mean that the retailer doesn't know that either?
That's correct. I mean, this type of substitution that we documented is called a fishery stock substitution. So it's a less desirable fishery stock or population being substituted for a more desirable one. In this case, the more desirable one is the MSC certified fishery. And because it's the same species, there is no way a consumer can pick that out at the seafood counter. Whereas with some species substitutions, a savvy consumer can spot a substitution, and they often do, but not with a fishery stock substitution.
But all of this is helping to make, hopefully, a little bit more savvy consumers as they go into a seafood counter and are able to ask questions. Even if someone behind the counter can't answer that, they get enough questions, maybe they're going to have to answer those questions.
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes and no. I mean, consumers that want to buy seafood and say want to buy sustainably sourced seafood or want to buy seafood that's low in mercury, they should always be asking questions. And they should also educate themselves with the FDA's websites. But in the case of these fishery stock substitutions, there really is no way for a consumer to tell. And if you think you're getting fish from this one particular population, it may be coming from another. And there just really isn't any way for anyone to know.
So, I mean, the bottom line of this seems to be that although we've been told for quite a while to be concerned about mercury levels within fish and that they do vary by species, we may not have any real control over what we eat when it comes to certain things like the sea bass.
Well, so that's, I think, is the most interesting thing of our study, is that it's pretty well established that there's great potential for a species substitution to expose a consumer to unwanted mercury. But our study showed that these fishery stock substitutions can have a bigger impact on exposure to higher mercury, because this MSC certified fishery is a population of fish that is well documented that have very, very low levels of mercury, whereas other populations from the Patagonian shelf, which is the southern tip of South America, those are well documented to having 2 to 3 times as much mercury, and as much mercury as the four fish that are on the FDA's do not eat list for pregnant women, women planning to have children, and children because of high levels of mercury. So these Chilean sea bass, which are not on the do not eat list, depending on where they come from, they can have mercury content that is as high as these four fish on the do not eat list.
Peter, that's really scary stuff for consumers to hear. What advice would you give them at this point, aside from maybe don't eat it at all?
Yeah, it took the words right out of my mouth. This makes it very complicated, and until we have more data from not just more species, but more data from across their species ranges, it's going to be very hard to make recommendations. I think that if a species is known to have high mercury, and Chilean sea bass is one of those, some consumer advocate agencies recommend don't eating it at all. So I would say if there's any known instances of high mercury, I would stay away from it, unless you're absolutely certain you know the relationship between how much mercury is expected from fish coming from a particular place or a particular country.
That's on the consumer end, but to go back to the retailer, I mean, clearly they don't want to have a bunch of sea bass or potentially other fish that may not be well represented and accurately represented on their or in their seafood counters. What are retailers doing? Anything yet that you know of?
No, I don't know of any retailers in the United States that are testing their fish, but it seems like a logical thing to do, not only to occasionally do surveys using genetics to test for species and stock substitutions, but also, you know, looking at mercury content of the fish. I mean, these things aren't cheap, but they're also not tremendously expensive. And anyone that I suppose did that could, you know, say that, you know, we regularly test our fish and here's what we know.
It might be a real opportunity for a retailer to be able to distinguish itself and gain a better market share.
Yeah, I think you're right. And these things are often easier said than done, but I think that may be where we're going one day.
But meanwhile, if you really want to be absolutely certain, just forget the Chilean sea bass for now.
Well, I can't tell people what to do, but personally, I would stay away from it from a variety of reasons. Often, it may not be from this sustainably sourced fishery, and if it isn't, and most of the Chilean sea bass that's imported into the United States comes from South America, and it's known to have high mercury content. So personally, I would stay away from it, but, you know, that's something for the consumer to make up their minds.
What's the next step for this survey and for you and your lab?
Well, we've published a few studies along these lines having to do with substitutions, and each one is sort of a little bit different. So if we can think of something new where we can present some sort of new result that hasn't been done before, then we'll probably look at it. So we have a couple things brewing, but I guess I'm not at liberty to tell you about them at the moment.
All right. Well, when you and your postdocs and the rest of the crew in your lab decide, let us know. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
All right. Thanks for having me, Beth Ann.
A pleasure. Peter Marco is a professor of evolution, biogeography, and conservation at UH Manoa. He's the lead author of the seafood study, and you can find it on our website, hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Life Real Estate Brokers, a locally owned company serving Oahu, Maui, Kauai, and the Big Island of Hawaii. Listings and information at hawaiilife.com.
Earlier in the show, we took a look at an event that took place exactly 95 years ago today. The event was a dedication of the dry dock at Pearl Harbor. At the time of the dock's construction, it was considered one of the largest and most advanced dry docks in the entire world. The achievement was considered so significant that August 21st was declared a public holiday in Hawaii that year. This was likely one of the main reasons so many people attended the dedication ceremony. To kick off the ceremony, Rear Admiral W.B. Fletcher was there. But he wasn't the only representative of the Navy present for the dedication, though. And for today's quiz, we asked you if you could tell us the name of the other high-ranking Navy representative present. As a hint, we told you that man was the Secretary of the Navy at the time of the ceremony. So who was he? It was Secretary of the Navy Josephus Daniels. That's the answer to today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Makana, guitar virtuoso, has gone from local slack key prodigy to international ambassador, taking his stylings through Europe over the summer with festival gigs in Paris and The Hague. His tour has broadened the audience for Kihualo, but has also expanded his own musical reach as he continues to interact with a variety of musicians and instrumental lineups. It's a process of continued growth, and he's on hand this morning. Tell us more about it. Good morning, Makana.
Aloha, Chris.
You know, when I hear about a tour like your summer tour, part of me thinks about what you're getting back out of it.
Oh, yes. I think about that a lot, too.
I imagine.
It's really recontextualizes my relationship to the art form. Back in 2002, when I first went to Paris, it was where I conceived my second record, Koyao. Mm-hmm. And the funny thing about it is on the cover is an Utagawa Kuniyoshi woodblock print from the 1800s. And just the other day at the Slack Key Festival, someone says, oh, but it's Japanese music? I said, no. This I conceived in Paris. And I had an epiphany that I wanted to do a truly contemporary Hawaiian music album. And if you look at the demographic of Hawaii today, it's largely Asian. So it's recontextualizing the Slack Key music. And going to a place like that really gives me a different perspective of our art.
I think it's important with anything like Slack Key or any art form to keep it alive that way.
Yeah, I was having a conversation this morning about tradition, and it's easy to look at tradition as an archaic relic, almost like a museum piece, and we must be very careful,
don't
it's got to be handled this way. Yeah, but if you look back to the facts, those that we consider traditional, like in this art form of Kiho'alu, Hawaiian slack key guitar, Gabby Pahinui, Sonny Chillingworth, mm-hmm. Leonard Kwan, Ledward Ka'apana and his kumu, Uncle Fred Punahoa, Raymond Kane,
the masters.
The Beamers. These people in their time were innovators. These people in their time did things that the kupuna at that time went, whoa. I remember Gabby, one of Gabby's most famous songs, uses a lick from Three Dog Night. And it's a Hawaiian song. We say that's traditional Hawaiian music. So tradition is a living entity.
And as it should be, because when you get to curatorial, when you start putting things in a museum, it's like you're putting on the brakes. I run into this with blues guitar. Well, that's the way Blind Willie Johnson did it in 1931. Well, yeah, okay. But he was busting boundaries back then. He would expect you to do the same.
Yeah, I think music needs to have two elements. You know, it's like it has to honor some sort of structure and form in terms of coming from the understanding of the instrument. You know, I'm paraphrasing something I thought of the other day that's totally relevant to this. It was mm-hmm. like, you know, a musician needs to do two things. First needs to build a city, kind of like Paris, this grand thing, and that takes eons of training and to build the architecture of being able to play. But then you have to carve your eyeballs out and walk through your own city blind. That's the process of music. You know, you need to first, I wouldn't say master, but you need to first really, really learn it. And you learn it from those who came before you. And once you do that, you have to just lose yourself in that.
Yeah, there's a lot of There's a learning followed by a lot of forgetting,
yes.
Sort of a kind of willful forgetting.
Yes,
where you're not bound by what you've learned. You're using what you've learned, and there's a big difference.
There is. And, you know, with something like slack key guitar, I mean, there's so much subtlety. And the reason is because the player is playing in what we call a slack key guitar tuning, like an open tuning.
Right.
So by nature, and, you know, like Gabby had over 100 of these, every time you change a tuning, you can't use your same muscle memory. So you're relearning, you become almost like a beginner again. But then what happens is you're doing the bass rhythm and melody. So when you hear slack key from one player, you're hearing so much of their personality because they are essentially the whole orchestra. So as you go through the different players and the different lineages from the different ohana, you start to hear these subtle differences. And that's, to me, the beauty of this art form. So much of the player's spirit goes into it.
And jealously hoarded back in the day. You'd hear stories of, well, my uncle played in this tuning, but he would turn his back when he was tuning it so that he couldn't figure it out.
Even for the kids, yeah, totally. Yeah. It was very private. Well, so much of the culture had been taken away.
Yeah.
So, you know, thankfully with recorded medium, Gabby and Leonard Kwan started to put this music out. It became available, yeah. And thanks to, you know, the work of a lot of the people today, from Uncle Led and Milton Lau with the Slack Key Festivals and George Winston, you know, bringing the awareness to this art form that really has been called a dying art form for the past 50 years.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear you mentioned Leonard Kwan, because I think he was a fantastic and very important artist who's not cited often enough when you hear about Kihoalo.
Really beautiful. And I got to meet Leonard at City Hall at the wake of Uncle Sonny. I'll never forget it. And what a humble, beautiful man.
Well, let's find some time to hear from you while you've got your guitar in hand.
And sure.
Tell me what you're going to play.
I was going to play a song by Andy Iona. And this comes from the era of like the 1920s, 1930s, when swing jazz from Hawaii, with kind of the Hapa Haole era, was just taking the world by storm.
Yeah.
And so this is a piece called How Do You Do?
Some very jazzy chords in there.
Yeah, Gabby and Anta recorded that back in the day. And it's a song that always appealed to me because it's not in the usual mode of the slack key.
But you can really hear the kind of a swing and a jazz influence in there.
Yeah, How Do You Do? Yeah, it was a classic era. The funny thing about Hawaiian music that blows my mind is it's been responsible for so much of the changes in music in general in the world. A couple little-known facts. Back in 1916 through the early 20s, Hawaiian music was the biggest-selling genre music in the world. And when the Great Depression happened, it was the sales of Sweet Leilani by Bing Crosby that boosted record sales again and jump-started the industry. And, of course, the steel guitar was invented here. So there's a lot of things that happened in Hawaii that went on to affect music worldwide.
Yeah, we tend to think of the things from outside that influenced here, but there's way more here influencing the outside world than most people know about.
Totally, totally.
Well, good luck with your continued musical journey. It's great to hear from you.
Thank you so much.
Happy
to be here.
Makana will give his final summer performance at the Kahala Hotel and Resort's Maile Ballroom Sunday evening. And you can find out more about that one at hpr2.org.
to say.
Aloha, Hawaii Island listeners. Please join us in beautiful Waimea for the first Applause from the Kahilu, August 24th at 4 p.m. This live performance showcases Big Island talent Ekolo Meanui with Sunny Lim, authentic Paniolo music, and more. HPR staff and volunteers will be at the Kahilu on Sunday the 24th. See you there. Tickets at kahilutheater.org.
Beth Ann, there's so much that continues to need to be sorted out about marijuana policy locally, nationally. It's so in flux right now.
Well, it in flux to a point. I mean, we've had it codified, and certainly given what happened two sessions ago, and we know about how things are at the moment. But as we heard from James Anthony at the top of the hour, as an attorney and as someone who specializes in dispensary land use, there's so much more that Hawaii has to do and that's so specific to Hawaii. And given the fact that we have people coming here from other places and making it easy for them to be able to get what they can get in their home states, that's an issue. But making sure that the people who are here are able to get their medical marijuana in a safe way is really what we're faced with right now.
But it's not as simple as, say, taking a template from another state that's farther along down the road, huh?
Well, some of that, I mean, he would make the case that there are some things that we can import because obviously you don't keep reinventing policy, but a lot of it would have to be tweaked for here because of where the population is that really needs to have access to it. And his whole point that this is only what we know now.
Yeah.
What happens when you actually have a fully functional system? And as he has said in other states, we will see who really needs to have medical marijuana based on the accessibility. And, that's yet to be determined.
And again, with medical care in Hawaii, the issue of being an island state with varied access island to island, just depending on where you are, that comes up again and again in discussions.
And it's going to keep coming up in this one, too, certainly in the discussions that James Anthony will be having across the state over the next couple of days to a week. That's going to do it for our Thursday run at the conversation. We will be back with you tomorrow. The Honolulu Bills at the City Council concerning homelessness are back. Catherine Gian says that advocates will also be back. We'll talk with her tomorrow.
And Sandy Sukiyama is going to give us a preview of her concert salute to women songwriters.
In the meantime, if you want to be in touch with us, lots of ways to do that on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation or at BKOZHPR. Email is there too. It's talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, you can get it at hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you in the morning back here for more of The Conversation.